There are several maps from the 16th century that are said to depict Antarctica with ice-free coasts, the most popular being the Peary Reeves map and the Arrontes-Fine map. In this video, we'll be discussing the Arrontes-Fine map in detail, much more detail than you've probably seen in the past. You've all seen the comparisons in the general shape and size, and a lot of times people will discuss certain sections of the coastline, but my friend and longtime supporter of the channel, Doug, has really dug into this and given us quite a layout of... Well, I'll just show you here as we go forward. But so grab yourself something to drink, strap yourself in and get comfortable because there's a lot of data about to hit you in the head. Hi, my name's Dan and welcome to Dedunking. Now, a couple things to point out really quickly. As we go forward, I'll be addressing the major criticisms against the map depicting Antarctica with ice-free coasts. And another thing to keep in mind is this map was said to be a compilation of source maps. So there will be times when we are looking at different projections and whatnot. So we'll bring that into account. You'll see when these things change. And we'll make sure and highlight it so you don't think I'm trying to pull some sleight of hand. Anyway, let's start talking about the map. Anyway, this map is a product of Arrontes-Fine in 1531, and he was considered one of the foremost cartographers of his day. Now, what we'll be focusing on today is this portion of the map, which will be noted as the OFTAR, standing for the Arrontes-Fine map Terra Australis Rae, but I'll just call it the Fine map during this video. This section of the map here, Fine called Terra Australis Rae, which literally translates to southern land recently discovered but not yet fully known. Anytime we have these kinds of discussions, one of the first things people are going to hammer away at is authenticity, so let's address that really quickly. This is the Nordenskjold Atlas, and it was published in 1889. A copy of the Fine map is in the publication, which is identical to the one that we'll be using today, except that our map is colored, similar to the one owned by the Library of Congress, which is approximately 450 years old. This is the Hachette map of Antarctica, which was published the next year. At this time, you can see that Antarctica is represented as little more than a white blob and a bit of the tip of the Palmer Peninsula. It was still mostly uncharted. This is a copy of the Collins map from 1912. You can see portions have been preliminarily mapped in pink, but even here, the bulk of the continent is still marked in white. At this point in history, we still had little understanding of what the overall shape of the continent looked like. It wasn't until 1965 that a clear picture was represented. So long story short, if the Fine map does indeed represent Antarctica, the bulk of the information on the Fine map was not available for like 400 plus years from the time the Fine map was published. That's noteworthy. So with that out of the way, let's address the big question, how do we compare dissimilar things? Most of the criticisms of the map have come from skeptics who declare that the Fine map and the real Antarctica maps look nothing alike, at least to them. Now, they often just use this as justification to dismiss the map out of hand. But we're going to be a little bit more scientific than that. We're going to look at pattern recognition. Not software. We're going to go old school with it. We're going to use, like, fingerprinting type of pattern recognition. Not exactly, but that's going to be our analogy. Since we're using the fingerprinting and verification process as a guideline, we're going to follow their four steps. The first is to develop a transparent overlay and align our objects as best as possible. In this case, our images of Antarctica. This needs to be done without distorting the images and is to establish a best fit template. Second, we need to find an anchor or a location on both images that is easily identifiable and the most alike between the two. Once that is done, we can use that transparent overlay to begin identifying what we will call points of correspondence. These are points that will be similar enough that most people would agree that they look similar. Next, we will total the number of points of correspondence without including ones that would be considered questionable. The same general shape, but in a slightly different location, or a similar set of shapes in the same sequence can be counted, so long as most casual observers would agree on these similarities. Now, the minimum number of points of correspondence to calculate similarities between two objects has to be at least 8, but of course, the higher that number, the more accurate you can make your comparison. As we finish the foundation, I want to thank the skeptics out there. I want to recognize you guys for all of your hard work in cut and pasting what other people have said about this map when just dismissing it because somebody else said they could dismiss it. And so you grab their talking points and somebody else grabbed those talking points and somebody else grabbed those talking points. So you end up with 50 people debunking the map with the exact same talking points that one guy made 15 years ago. Good job, guys. Very impressed. But... all right, that's being a little bit mean. But seriously, it is a little ridiculous, and it's a shame, because as you'll see here, a little bit of actual scrutiny with an open mind, and bear with me, things are about to get really interesting. Now, almost all of them make the same 10 basic claims about why the Feeney map can't be an authentic depiction of Antarctica. Number one, Hapgood had to shuffle enormous chunks of the coastline around to make the map look like the real Antarctica, essentially fabricating the final product. Two, Antarctica has been covered by ice for the last anywhere from 10 to maybe 35 million years, and in most cases, the ice has been miles thick. Three, the section in question is substantially larger than the real Antarctica. Four, even if the two maps were the same size, the Feeney map has only a very vague similarity to the real Antarctica. Five, the most significant difference between the two is the total lack of an Antarctica peninsula on the Feeney map. Six, beyond that, portions of the Feeney map look more like an amorphous blob, or maybe Africa, on the north coast of Australia. But it looks nothing like the real Antarctica. 7. There is a difference in rotation between the Feeney map and the real Antarctica by as much as 20 degrees. 8. There are scores of other maps showing the southern continent made during the 1500s and 1600s that look nothing like the Feeney map, so the map must just be a lucky guess. 9. Even if there are similarities between the maps, there are no known cultures that could have mapped Antarctica 10 to 12,000 years ago. 10. Finally, without proof of how, and by whom, the map was made, and how it found its way from the Ice Age to Renaissance France, the map must be considered nothing more than a remarkable piece of guesswork. All of these are reasonable concerns, so let's analyze them as we analyze the map hand in hand. Debunker claim number one, Hapgood had to shuffle enormous chunks of the coastline around to make the map look like the real Antarctica, essentially fabricating the final product. Okay, this is just ignorant because it depends on the type of projections that are being used. Take a look at all of these projections. Are we to assume that the makers of the Mercator map really think Antarctica is as big as North America, South America, and Europe combined? Or that the Gall Peters map makers thought Antarctica is smaller than Australia? Or that the maker of the good Holocene map and Waterman butterfly maps actually believed that Antarctica is made up of four separate islands? Of course not. In each case, the different type of map projection used leads to very different results. This same could well be true for the Feeney map. So let's analyze the first claim with that in mind. The projection that Feeney used was a double heart-shaped projection. But the Antarctic maps we'll be using are all polar projections. This requires us to convert the Feeney quarter-form projection into a simple polar projection. To do that, we need to transform the curved lines of longitude on the Feeney map into the straight lines used on a polar projection. Now here's the important part. As you make the curved lines of the Feeney map straight, you need to pin the land masses to their longitudinal and latitudinal lines and move them along with these newly straightened lines. Without this, the points of reference will be lost, making the lines meaningless. When that is done, you should end up with this. The Feeney map in a polar projection. So issue number one is resolved, right? Well, not quite. There's still a little bit more to do. See, the Feeney map currently has the west of the right side of the map and the east on the left, just the opposite of standard Antarctic maps. So to fix this, we just spin the map 180 degrees, and then it will line up with our conventional map of the region. And now this is what you get when you invert the map. West Antarctica is on the left side, East Antarctica is on the right, just like normal Antarctic maps. Nothing has been distorted or modified. And we are left with this, over which we overlay a map of the real Antarctica, centered at the real South Pole. Having done that, how do we make these two maps of comparable size without just eyeballing it? Well, let's try this. The outer blue circle is the Tropic of Capricorn, and the inner red circle is the Antarctic Circle. Now, these are the only 2 degrees of latitude in the southern hemisphere that are fixed by solar observations. All others are arbitrary. So let's assume that perhaps Feeney got these two circles messed up on his map. And then if we shrink the Tropic of Capricorn down to the size of the Antarctic Circle, this obviously reduces the size of Feeney's map. One final transformation will be needed to make these the same size and same orientation. We will move Feeney's Antarctica up into the northeast until it sets over the real Antarctica. This move is about 600 miles and is done to give us a best fit layout for our analysis. We'll go into why Feeney may have made this move later in the presentation. In summary, we've reduced the Feeney map in size from the Tropic of Capricorn down to the Antarctic Circle, turned the map upside down, and shifted Feeney's continent to the northeast by 600 miles. These are the only modifications we have made to his map. This gives us two maps of the same size that we can actually compare, which brings us to debunker claim number two. Even if the maps were the same size, there are many significant differences between the real Antarctica and the one on the Feeney map. So let's take a look at that. We'll start with the general shape of the two continents. Note that the Feeney map and Antarctica are divided into two unequal lobes, A and B, formed by two major embayment areas separating them. A is on the lower left side of the map, B is on the right. You'll notice Lobe A is considerably larger than Lobe B. Lobe A is broadly circular in shape, as is the outline of West Antarctica below it, if you exclude the Antarctic Peninsula, which we will do at least for now. The reason we'll be doing that, hint hint, has to do with the ice cover of Western Antarctica between 10 and 12,000 years ago. And while Lobe B of the Fine map is not an exact match for the image of Antarctica beneath it, it has approximately 80% less land, it does have the same general shape, with the direction of the long short axis of the land masses more or less aligning. Now keep in mind that Fine supposedly made this with a complete lack of data, so that is kind of remarkable because it does look a lot like each other. So we'll actually call this our first point of correspondence. Let's move to the next phase of this analysis, the Fine reference map. If you take the bulk of ice off Antarctica, three major embayment areas become apparent. These spaces are the easiest to analyze, while attempts to investigate the coastal locations of rivers and glaciers between the two maps is more open to personal interpretation. The three embayment areas are the embayment area Ross Ice Shelf, which this ice shelf is the anchor between the two maps, the embayment area Filcher Ice Shelf, and these two portions of our map do not overlap, and the embayment area Amory Ice Shelf, known as the EAA for short. The National Geographic map of Antarctica of 1987 will be used for comparison with the Fine map. This is primarily because it is the last year Nat Geo made a delineation between ice shelves and the more or less permanent ice cover, allowing us to see the same areas on both maps. Okay, so we're going to start with our first detailed comparison between the portion of the Fine map that corresponds with the Filcher ice shelf on the Nat Geo map. But before we get started, please note that we have rotated the Fine map about 22 degrees clockwise in order to bring these two images into alignment. Also, note the red and black arrows in the upper left-hand corner. The black arrow indicates areas of ice and snow cover that are more or less permanent, while the red is the dashed lines where the ice floats on the water of the adjacent ocean. It's a bit more complicated than that, but that's beyond the scope of this video. The red arrows indicate portions of the Fine map, where the black indicate portions of the Nat Geo map. First, notice the Thiel Mountains in the black oval and Fine's cluster of mountains nearby. Given their proximity to each other, I'll call this our second point of correlation after the general shape of the two landmasses. In both cases, the mountains are above and roughly parallel to the upper crook of the fork at the end of the Foundation ice stream. This is the Academy Glacier. Note the long neck of the Foundation ice stream and how it splits in two at the end. In both cases, this fork has two tines. One of these breaks off and then twists back until it's running roughly parallel to the main branch. The forks at the end of the Foundation ice stream are not exact matches, but have the same shape. The only real difference is that one twists up while the other twists down, running adjacent to the Foundation ice stream and not quite parallel to it, and roughly the same length, is the Support Force Glacier. Here's the Chambers Glacier, about halfway down the length of the Support Force Glacier, on the left-hand side angling in. The Slusher Glacier, I believe. It's not directly aligned with the Fine Maps Glacier, but it does have the same basic length and shape. It needs to be noted that there is another glacier shown on current maps of the area, but not on Fine's. It's called the Recovery Glacier and sits almost exactly where Fine shows this glacier. The Lurchenfeld-Bailey Glacier, coming in near the mouth of the Slusher on the right side at a steep angle. And here we have a glacier for which we could not find a name. This portion of the Filchner ice shelf is long and narrow on both maps. Both embayment areas have a narrow entry. Notice there are no deep river glaciers or other indents along the top portion of the map. Now it is possible Fine would have put features like this in just to balance out what he had done below, a not uncommon convention in map making at the time. Now this one will not be counted as a point of correspondence, but it's the grounding line between the Rhone and Filchner ice shelves, the area where the bedrock is closer to the surface, and the ice shelf remains much more stable. The Ellsworth mountain range, which will become more important later on. And here's the only missing river slash glacier on this portion of the map. And next we'll be moving to the Ross Sea area. To begin this part of the examination, we'll be placing the two islands on the Fine map directly over those on the Nat Geo map. This will give us the best fit for our analysis. Keep in mind this was said to have been made with multiple source maps, so if we find small variations like this, that does make sense. Now as can be seen, these two maps do not align nearly as well as those of the Fine-Filchner map. But what will become very apparent as we begin identifying various rivers and glaciers is that even though the items do not align perfectly, the type and approximate sizes are still quite compelling. For instance, we have Roosevelt Island. Both are long and narrow and point into the wedge-shaped bay. Ross Island. Then starting in the lower left and moving clockwise, we find the round or mitten-shaped Prestrud Inlet. Next is the iStream F, also called the Echelmeyer iStream, followed by iStream E, the McHale iStream, and then iStream D, the Beinschadler or Simple Bay. The subsurface in this is more complicated than that shown on the Nat Geo map, but this rough approximation of the area shows us enough to look for points of correspondence. Not counted in our total, but the spot where ice melting in the Ross Ice Shelf would run aground. The Beardmore Glacier, one of the three on this side of the Ross Ice Shelf. Note the left branch of the glacier, similar to what is shown on the Fine map. The Nimrod Glacier. The Bird Glacier. Admittedly, these two areas don't seem to line up with anything that we know about the region. Still, we have so many similarities that it seems to already be beating chance, but let's continue. Next, we'll look at the mountains in and around Antarctica. We'll use the original Fine map without modifications, so the mountain and mountain chain locations on the map can be clearly seen. The adjacent map has been inverted to give us an apples-to-apples comparison. Let's look at some features. We have the Admiralty Mountains at the tip of the Ross Sea, distinct from the Transantarctic Range. The Transantarctic Mountains. Now right here, it does get a little confusing. There's two sets of mountains, essentially back-to-back. We have both the Thiel Mountains, which have already been counted, and the Whitmore or Horlick Mountains, which have not. So we will count these as separate and distinct sets of mountains. The Rockefeller Plateau and the area with only low, shallow hills. The Flood or Executive Committee Range. The Ellsworth Mountains, noted but not counted before. Coatesland, a long stretch where there are very few, if any, noticeable hills. The Soar Mundane and Queen Fabiola Mountains. Fabio. The Prince Charles Mountains. Notice how both generally point towards the interior of the continent. Wilkes Land is an area of very high ice cliffs and may be depicted in places, but nothing in this area will be counted as a point of correspondence. So there are at least 32 significant points of correspondence, and since I can't ask you, hey, what do you agree with me on or not agree with me on, we'll just eliminate 12 of them and we'll say that we've got 20. And even that gives us way more than the 8 that a fingerprinter would want if these were fingerprints, but I don't know. You tell me, what do you think? Do you find this compelling so far or not? To me, it seems pretty interesting. What is pretty interesting here is we have a possible method for comparing and analyzing any two maps that does not rely on individual personal impressions as much as a consensus. It looks like Antarctica to me is one thing, but most people agree these look similar enough to possibly be the same as they line up neatly. That's something completely different. So let's go to debunker claim number 3. The scientific consensus has been that the Antarctica of today is buried under miles of ice and its land masses and glaciers have not been free of that ice for the last 10 million years, perhaps up to 35 million years. But that's an overarching claim. If we look closer, how much of that's actually true? This is an article that was published in National Geographic in 2018. It highlights how 10 to 12,000 years ago, the West Antarctic ice sheet underwent a major retreat. It also describes how the ice may have retreated as much as 300 to 400 miles inland during this period. And this is not a lone piece of research, but supported by additional work being done over the last few years. Debunker claim number 4 is asking, why don't we have the Antarctic Peninsula on the map? That's a pretty distinct feature of Antarctica. You would think they would have thought to map it. Why ain't it there? This is a map of Antarctica with this ice stripped away. East Antarctica is at the top, West Antarctica is at the bottom, and the Ross Sea is on the right, and the Filchner on the left. Off to the far left is the Antarctic Peninsula. The Antarctic Peninsula is separated from West Antarctica by the Bentley Subglacial Trench, a deep chasm that divides the land masses in two. This is the Bentley Trench, and when we get a better look at it, you can see the separation, both along the Bentley Trench and the adjacent Ellsworth Trench. The major problem, of course, is that we have no idea when the Fine map might have been plotted. At the beginning of the ice cover collapse, perhaps, at its height, or during its reformation. And how would the isostatic rebound, that is the land slowly rising after the weight of the glaciers is removed, interact with the rising sea levels? So without specifying exactly when or what it would have looked like, it is fair to say that the Antarctic Peninsula would have been separated sometime in the last 10, 12,000 years. So it wouldn't have looked exactly like it does now on the maps. Now, this doesn't prove that the Fine map is right, but it does show that that debunker claim is a little bit half-baked. Now, notice the red box on the left here showing the area and its enlargement. You can also see there's no direct link between these two land masses. If the Fine map was drawn 10 to 12,000 years ago, these would be two separate pieces of land. Moving on, let's go back to that whole the Fine map is substantially larger, 230% larger than the real Antarctica thing. Now, even though this is in the 16th and 17th century, if there was anybody to blame for this stuff, you have to go way back to Claudius Ptolemy. In Aristotle's time, around 350 BC, everyone who was anyone in the natural philosophy community knew the Earth was a sphere and it obviously had to have a massive southern continent to keep the whole world from becoming unbalanced and flipping over. It was Claudius Ptolemy's later scientific work, A Guide to Geography, that proved this theory and became the most influential reference guide for Renaissance mapmakers. A quick review of almost all world maps from this period, the mid-1500s to the mid-1700s, have such a large imaginary southern landmass because, you know, it was science, right? Now, a random assortment of different shapes to be sure, but no matter what it looked like, it had to be massive. It had to balance out the north. And there's a long story about the church supporting his work instead of other geographers due to his model of the heavens most aligning with their idea of an earth-centric universe. But essentially, by the beginning of the Renaissance, it was common knowledge that there was, and had to be, a massive continent in the south. Ptolemy had proven it mathematically, right? So Finney was just following the science of his day when he made his depiction of Terra Australis so large. Now, we don't know whether Finney's source maps had lines of latitude and or longitude, but the assumption should be that the makers of his source maps had some way of identifying each. And as I said earlier, the Tropic of Capricorn and the Antarctic Circle are the only two lines here that are defined by the sun. The rest are arbitrary, making these ones stand out and the other ones potentially be not such a big deal. And with this, Finney's Antarctica is back to being massive just like it started. Now, for all of his supposable mathematical prowess, Ptolemy miscalculated the circumference of the globe by up to 25%, which is a pretty big mistake. Now, on the one hand, it encouraged Columbus to sail the oceans blue and discover America, as he thought the trip was going to be considerably shorter than it turned out to be. Whether or not that was a good or bad thing, you can argue about in the comments below. Be nice. On the other hand, cartographers using his calculations and theories, again, the science of the day, well, they were forced to position a massive continent at or near the South Pole. And when it comes to maps of the globe, you see this in a ton of the 16th and 17th century ones. If we move the map down and to the left, we can put Antarctica back in its original position. And as you can see, portions of the Finney map look more like an amorphous blob, or maybe Africa, or the north coast of Australia. But nothing like the real Antarctica. But is it like the blob from the 1950s creature feature? Is it an amorphous without a shape? Well, I think we've already seen at this point, not only does it have some definition, but it does actually resemble Antarctica pretty well. Now, this image here from Mercury's 1538 map, that's more amorphous. Maybe it's Africa, I guess. Maybe you could squint real hard. Or if you use a converted projection, it's still no dice. Now, it's important to note, Africa was well known and fairly mapped by this period, and simply placing a modified Africa at the South Pole, that would be a rookie mistake. On this portion of the Finney map shows the hypothetical Ross Sea looking more like the Bay of Carpentaria at the northern end of Australia, something that might have been mapped by early Portuguese explorers. So is the Finney map just a misshapen map of northern Australia and not Antarctica at all? Well, I'm sorry, but no. This is a copy of Nicholas Delison's 1554 world map, 23 years after the Finney map was published. And if you look at the lower right-hand corner, you'll see a red box enclosing what looks to be Australia. And here's a blow-up of the area with the label, Java La Grande. This whole area was thought of as a part of the large island of Java. But looking closer at the potential Bay of Carpentaria, we can see a very large island out in the center of the bay, and the bay being a deep wedge shape that points straight into the heart of the continent. And it is at the end of a very long river. Now take note of the number of large islands right at the entrance of the bay. Next, let's see how close the large islands, assuming Java and maybe New Guinea, are to the north coast. Not that either of these issues shows the Deslian's map was or wasn't depicting the bay, but it does seem that there is as much of an issue with his map as there is with Finney's. Now, before we leave this topic, and on the assumption that some aren't convinced that Finney didn't model his Ross Sea on the stash of secret Portuguese maps, let's take a closer look at this area. You will see number one is an outline of the Ross Sea from the Finney map. Number two is a geophysical map of the Gulf. Number three is a smaller bay down the north coast that some have thought looks like the Finney's map. Number four is King's Gulf, shown to just complete the depiction of the bays along the north coast. Number five is a map showing the large islands of the bay and the rivers that lead to the bay. And lastly, number six is an example of the slow meandering rivers typical of this area in the north of Australia. This wide red box-like shape in the bay of number two is very different what was seen in number one. Notice on the Finney map, this island is tucked tightly in the corner of the land and sits at the mouth of the large river. In neither maps 2 or 5 is Groot Island tucked into the corner, nor is there any major river nearby. On the Fine map, Roosevelt Island is long and narrow, on the right side of the map and pointing into a deep bay. Mornington Island is on the left side of the Carpentaria Bay and is not in or near the mouth of anything. Lastly, there are the Vanderlyn Islands, again shown on the west side of the bay, without any corresponding such islands on the Fine map. I'm belaboring the point a little bit because way too many bunkers throw the Gulf of Carpentaria around as the real origin of the embayment area of the Ross Sea without ever seeming to look at the two and comparing the differences. Debunker claim number 7, there's a lot of maps from back then that depict Antarctica because, that Potomac convention of putting a big landmass on the bottom, so this is just a lucky guess. Move along. Let's start by looking at some of those maps. First, the North Pole map by Mercator and Honduras from 1606. Now, this is what a real imaginary map looks like. Divided into 4 more or less equal parts, with an island dead center of the interior bay, 4 rivers, each with major delta and a continuous mountain chain around the perimeter. Mountains are always a plus, right? Now, the next map is Mercator's 1538 world map, where he pretty much just copied Fine's 1531 map. Notice the bottom of the Ross Sea, upper red box, and the Filchner Ice Shelf, the other red box, both just slapped in there, as is the perimeter of the whole continent. Mercator didn't mind stealing, but he had his doubts about Fine's Terra Australis. Lastly, look at the circle showing where the massive southern continent touches South America. Here's Francisco Rosselli's 1508 world map. At this time, nobody was sure what was really going on in the Western Hemisphere, and this was Rosselli's best guess. Notice the large Terra Australis. And back again to Nicholas Delsian's 1554 map of the world. And notice this big red circle. By this time, everybody had got into the idea of that massive Terra Australis touching South America. And if you look deeply, you'll notice that nobody uses Delsian's outline of North Australia after he does. Next is Paolo Sforlani's 1565 world map. Things are becoming clearer, landmasses are more recognizable, but they still just include all kinds of features, like in this case, mountains are just everywhere. Here's Mercator's 1569 world map. Seems that he abandoned Fine's outline of Antarctica and Delsian's Australia for his own invention, but his map messes up the west coast of South America pretty badly and shows his Terra Australis smack up against New Guinea. He should have stuck with Fine's map, but even in this one, South America connects with Terra Australis. Here's 3 more connections. Le Havre's 1583 map showing South America and Terra Australis. Petrus Planchio's 1594 map showing the same thing. And even Jodocus Hondios' 1618 map still shows them connected. And New Guinea connected to Terra Australis. Okay, with all that taken care of, let's go to debunker claim number 8. What about the difference in orientation, being off by about 20 degrees? To answer that, we'll need some backstory. This is the area that would eventually become known as the Straits of Magellan. Sailors had attempted to sail around the southernmost tip of South America for years, but were all either turned back or had their ships destroyed. It wasn't until 1520 that Magellan found a way through the straits that bear his name, but during this time, no one was sure how to get through safely, and there were a number of false starts. Exploring their way through this mess of islands, one of Magellan's ships hit Useless Bay. They looked for all kinds of supplies there, but the bay lived up to its name, and they left empty-handed. However, the bay did find its way into Magellan's logbooks and onto his maps. This is why all cartographers afterwards drew the tip of South America touching the southern land, aligning their maps with what had been recently discovered, the southern end of Tierra del Fuego. So what does this have to do with the 20-degree rotation? Okay, the Fine map is back to its original size and location, right? Now what? Like all the other cartographers of his day, Fine heard about this massive inlet once Magellan's fleet returned. And like any good mapmaker, he fit this new knowledge of the bay into the end of South America on a southern continent with the newly discovered label, and he adjusted his map accordingly. But to do this, his southern continent needed to be rotated by about 20 degrees to bring the only large inlet/bay in line with South America. Now notice there are no other large bays or inlets on this side of his map. So without modifying the outline of his map, the Fine map of Terra Australis now has a land recently discovered but not yet fully mapped, just like in Magellan's records. The Useless Bay now lines up just where it needs to be and where it is shown on Fine's world map. Well, I think that's a good enough explanation that I'm going to move to debunker claim number 9. There was no civilization 10 to 12,000 years ago that could have possibly mapped this, and even if there had been, we've no agency to get it all the way into 15th, 16th century France, so this obviously is just it's just a pipe dream, it's just luck, it's just guesswork, it's conjecture. Debunker claim number 10 is very similar to debunker claim number 9, so I'm going to lump them together. They both basically say we don't know how this happened, so we're going to assume that it's guesswork without more evidence. But to me, that's kind of ridiculous. I mean, we can't even speculate? Okay. In this case, we have like 20 points of correspondence I would think we could agree on, and that's pretty interesting. That's pretty compelling. Definitely means that there might be more here worth looking at, right? But not according to the debunkers. They just throw the baby out with the bathwater. But what would the implications of this be? Really, the only alternatives are that Fine made a series of really remarkable guesses, which that doesn't really seem to line up very well with all the points of correlation. The National Geographic Antarctica map of 1987 could be a hoax just concocted to make people like me look really stupid. And, you know, they get the United States Geological Survey in on the whole deal. No, I probably couldn't get them to check out my pet rock, but maybe they are into fooling people like me. I don't know. Or it could be a form of pareidolia, just our minds playing tricks on us, like the faces in the clouds. But I think most people are aware that pareidolia tends to generally be living things or common objects. I've never seen somebody look up in the sky and be like, wow, that looks like a map of China. It just doesn't happen. That could just be our ancient alias space brothers mapping things with the satellite. But if that was the case, they probably should calibrate their equipment a hair or, you know, get better at leaving better maps, because this one was a little sketch for people that navigate the universe. Or maybe Aron Sfine was some kind of remote viewer or psychic. I mean, he did go to jail for unknown reasons when he was young, like Nostradamus. But there's a big question that would come to mind. Why would he have seen a map of Antarctica that showed the continent 10 to 12,000 years before he was born? And anyway, that whole avenue of questioning is just going to open more questions than answers, so we'll just avoid that. Well, how about the law of very large numbers? I mean, this is kind of like he got lucky with guessing. It's like if you take 100 people, have them all flip a coin, and then you take all the people that got heads and have them flip a coin, and take all the people that got heads and have them flip a coin. You do this 10 times, and you're still going to have people that have flipped heads every time, and they've just done it 10 times in a row, which mathematically is highly improbable, but you started with enough people that comes out. Which that would make sense if there were tens of thousands of these maps, but there's only like 100 of them or less, so that doesn't really make a lot of sense that one would match this well on both a macro and a micro scale. Or it could be that it was a known culture, but one that didn't document their trip to Antarctica. I mean, this is doubtful, but it's possible. I remember our ice-free shorelines go back 10 to 12,000 years ago. There were some 5 to 6,000 years ago, but they were piecemeal by comparison. And even if we assume somebody was sailing around the South Pole back in 5 to 6,000 years ago, we don't have any idea who they could have been. Now, it is possible a culture followed Antarctica oases around for a few hundred years back in those days, 5 to 6,000 years ago, in order to form a proper coastal map, but that seems extremely far-fetched. Now, let's quickly run down the list of potential suspects. The Minoans were a powerful seafaring culture based in the eastern Mediterranean. Getting their start circa 4 to 5,000 years ago, they were known to have eventually sailed to England and the Indus Valley. But these voyages didn't come till 4,000 years before present, so it's probably not the Minoans. The Egyptians were good sailors, at least along the Nile and the Red Sea, but those waters are relatively calm. The Egyptians were not known for sailing outside of their waters. How about the Phoenicians? According to Herodotus, they sailed around Africa in 600 BC, but there's no evidence that they went very much south of the Cape of Good Hope. And by 600 BC, all evidence points to Antarctica being frozen solid again. The Polynesians, at least according to their oral traditions, sailed south until they came to tall white mountains sticking out of the water. Considered most likely icebergs, these voyages didn't occur until at least the beginning of the Christian era, and even then, no member of the Polynesian fleets had anything that a French cartographer would consider maps of the area. Here's a fun one, although they come about 10,000 years too late. The Chinese treasure fleets were massive. Their treasure ships 300 to 350 feet long and capable of carrying 500 to 600 men. They grew their own fruits and vegetables, and the ships would have been superb for getting to and mapping Antarctica. But sadly, no. Not only are they much too late in the record, the Chinese seemed only interested in impressing their neighbors and going to the southern tip of Java, the middle of Africa, and to Egypt. After 100 years of showing off, they burned all their ships and most of the records. Here's a quick comparison of those Chinese treasure ships and the European carvels. One more option presents itself. How about a relatively advanced but unknown prehistoric civilization that mapped the Antarctic continent 8 to 14,000 years ago? Alright, but how relatively advanced? Flying cars and crystals and lasers and all that? Well, almost certainly not. But it does seem that they had some way of finding accurate longitude. Some sort of working timepiece? Well, maybe, but there were a lot of ways of getting a rough idea of longitude then using a telescope and complicated math. This would have to be a really impressive navy, capable of sailing all the way to and surviving. I mean, remember, they went up and mapped some individual streams and tributaries on these maps, potentially, right? So they weren't just sailing around it. They had to go up into there. It's pretty impressive. In addition to the ability to explore and map significant portions of the ancient world, they would have actually had to have done it. Now think about that for a moment. You develop great sailing ships, a great fleet, and the first thing you say is, hey, let's sail to the end of the world? Probably not. More likely, you're doing it to trade or war, or a combination of both. And in addition to that, they presumably had some way to get that information from their time all the way into 15th century France. Although that might actually just have been luck of people storing those maps over the years and passing them around and copying them. That doesn't necessarily require their reach to have still existed at that time, right? There's a lot of speculation here, but there was also a lot of very close, like, pattern analysis, right? So this is pretty interesting to me. Does this necessarily prove that it was mapped back then? Well, I can't say that it does, but I will say that it definitely puts me from the, I'm not 100% on this, to dang, this is some pretty impressive stuff. Doug did the vast majority of this legwork on his own. I basically just went through and proofread some things, double checked a few things that I thought might have needed double checking, and then made this into a package to present to y'all. So I really want to thank you so much, Doug, for putting the work into this. And just so that people know, I'm not just going to take any old submission, so please don't just, like, I have some people that just hounded me with things, and there's some ideas that are not interesting to me. Doug showed me this, and I was like, hot damn, this is cool, and I haven't seen it anywhere else. Let's put this out into the world. So understand that, please, okay? But I want to say that when you have something like this here, this really does betray, this is why it's important to give these goofball claims a fair shake, goofball claims, because there is often more than meets the eye here. Even if this doesn't prove Ice Age people mapped it, all of a sudden we are seeing things that look a whole lot more like that's possible than when you're just looking at the rough shape. It is the kind of work that hasn't probably been done since Hapgood's time. And we don't really have anybody else working on that except for to debunk these things. And again, they just recycle the same crap over and over and over again. Anyway, you've probably listened to me babble enough at this point. Thank you very much for watching this far. Big thanks to my patrons. Extra special thank to Doug. And we will see you all next time.